And what he means by that, without his saying so, is that when you see the way that the material has changed, you know which way it is going. Bruce Metzger, whose name I mentioned before, certainly a conservative scholar, one of those interviewed by Lee Strobel in his Case for Christ. In his book, which I have here with me, The New Testament, Its Background, Growth, and Content, he has given several examples showing how Matthew and Luke, in their own ways, have improved upon the information once it was there in Mark. So if there was something showing a limitation of Jesus, Matthew and Luke omit it. If there was something that would heighten the greatness of Jesus, they definitely try to heighten it in their own ways. And in several different ways, they have made the changes. I've already shown tonight that whereas Pilate was amazed that Jesus could have died so soon, according to the Gospel of Mark, it is noted that Matthew and Luke, in their own ways, omitted that mention. So one would find that out from Mark, but not from Matthew and Luke. Remember, these Gospels had circulated in different areas, and eventually in the middle of the second century, they were collected together as a single document. So readers of one did not necessarily know what's in the other, but the writers knew. So where do we find that Jesus appeared to his disciples over a 40-day period? We find that in the Acts of the Apostles, which is written by Luke. It's not in Mark. Moreover, where do we find that he ate fish with his disciples? In the Gospel of Luke. Where do we find that he appeared to Thomas? In the Gospel of John. Now, the Gospels are interesting in the way that they have worked this over. If you go to Mark, he doesn't appear to anyone, as Mark narrates. There is no recorded narration in Mark showing that he actually appeared to anyone. Matthew has one appearance in Galilee. But in that appearance, it says that the disciples saw him, but they doubted. People have problems with this. Translators have difficulties with this. What do you mean they doubted? They weren't sure it was really Jesus? So some word it such that you would think that some of the disciples doubted, but not all. And some word it such that you would think that some other people doubted, but not the disciples themselves. Close of Matthew's Gospel. No more about reappearances. Go to Luke. Luke has it that Jesus appeared to two disciples on the road to Emmaus. At first, they do not recognize him, even though he had a long conversation with them. But when he sat down to break bread with them, that is when their eyes opened and they recognized him. But then he vanished from their sight. And then they said, weren't our hearts burning when he spoke to us? So they were convincing themselves that this was really Jesus. They go back to Jerusalem. They find the disciples there. They're told, yeah, the Lord has indeed risen, appeared to Peter, but no description of that is given. Suddenly, Jesus there appears in the room with them. People think he walked through the door, but the Gospel does not actually say this. Jesus could have been already in the room. But the important thing to notice is that this event itself may not be historical. Now, Luke tells us plainly that Jesus appeared here to the 11, because there were 12 minus 1. Judas Iscariot went his own way. But John now will split this up so that Jesus appears to them while there were only 10. Thomas is missing on Easter day. And then Jesus comes back the week later to appear to Thomas and give him physical proof that he had actually risen from the dead. And says, here, Thomas, put your finger here. Put your hand in the side. So whereas we have on Easter day Luke telling us that Jesus appeared to the 11, John contradicts that by telling us that there were two appearances, one to 10 on Easter day, and on another occasion to convince Thomas a week later. So you see that as you go from one gospel to another, the number of witnesses increase. The surety of his death is emphasized. The fact of his reappearance to his disciples is emphasized and multiplied. More people see him. So Dr. Montgomery thinks that the opponents of Jesus would have objected to this. But when did they find out? 50 days later, after the claimed resurrection. By that time, you couldn't oppose that because you couldn't find a properly identifiable body, especially since in the first place they needed Judas Iscariot to identify him. I rest my case with this.
It would be unfortunate if the debate degenerated into an argument as to how good a scholar Raymond Brown is. Seems to me that we're going to have to recognize that in New Testament scholarship, there are two approaches that are taken today. One approach is the higher critical approach that Raymond Brown represents. That approach says we need to examine the New Testament writings to see if there are apparent stylistic differences among them, instances where it would appear that later editors have put material together that was not in that same form earlier. That approach on the one hand, and the approach which really follows Aristotle's dictum that you give the benefit of the doubt to the writer, and you assume that if there are no textual evidences of variation, that the material did indeed come from a single author. Interestingly enough, C.S. Lewis, who was one of the greatest authorities in English literature and English textual criticism in the 20th century, did an article on this subject. The article is entitled Biblical Criticism, and in it, Lewis says, "The amazing thing to me is that the critics think that 2,000 years after the events, they can in effect redo the New Testament material to find out what is really genuine and what isn't, even though all of it comes from documents which we have known for that length of time." Lewis says, critics have tried to do this with my Narnian Chronicles, to find out what the real sources of my Narnian Chronicles were. They, says Lewis, are doing this in my own time, in my own language, and they have never been right, never once. Says Lewis, the trouble with that kind of critical approach to literary material is that it is subjective. And Mr. Ali has so well demonstrated this. He has said again and again, this is development. This because something is given in more detail later than it was apparently given earlier. Therefore, the later material is not necessarily genuine and is a modification or a perversion of the earlier material. But neither Mr. Ali nor I were around at the time. We have only the resultant documents on which to rely in order to determine what actually happened. When I took classics at Cornell University, Greco-Roman studies as an undergraduate, I had a professor by the name of Harry Kaplan, who was quite a wag, and Kaplan said, you know, higher criticism, the sort of thing, and he would have used Raymond Brown as an example, had Brown been writing at that time. He said, this higher critical approach was used for 75 years in Homeric scholarship to find out the real sources and the contradictions and the development in the Iliad and the Odyssey. And after 75 years, we have come to the conclusion that the Iliad and the Odyssey were either written by Homer or by someone of the same name who lived about the same time. If you want to get into the question of the reliability of the Gospel of John, go to the classic work on this, Theodor Zahn's work on the Gospel of John, the three volumes early in the 20th century, Theodor Zahn. Even J.A.T. Honest to God Robinson, who was hardly a conservative theologically, even Robinson did a book on the Gospel of John in which he argued that John was the first of the Gospels. Now, that hasn't been followed in general in New Testament scholarship, but this shows that Mr. Ali may not start with Mark as necessarily the first gospel and then go to Matthew and Luke and then to John and argue this developmental thesis. The fact is that it's possible for something more developed and complex to be written early and then a shorter version done later for other purposes. People have argued that the gospel according to Mark was done as a short catechetical treatise and left out a lot of material simply because its purpose was to offer just the basic catechetical understanding. The fact of the matter is that we can't determine the exact order of the four Gospels, but we can determine their date, their provenance, their date, their authorship. Harnack, at the end of the 19th century, pointed out that in the book of Acts, Paul's death is not given, but the book focuses on Paul. Therefore, says Harnack, it's clear that the book was written before Paul died. Anybody doing a biography of someone tends to include the death. It's important. It ends the biography. So Acts was written before the death of Paul. We know Paul died in 64-65, and Acts is the second part of Luke. Luke was written before Acts. We know this from the way in which the two books begin. Everyone agrees to that. And Luke says that he relied upon existing sources. The sources surely included Mark. And so this is pushing all of this material back between 64-65 and the death of Christ around 30. That's 35 years. That means all of these gospel writings were in circulation during the generation immediately following the death of Christ. And the people who wrote this stuff were available. And it says in the book of Acts, and we know this by other sources as well, that the early Christians went out and preached primarily to the synagogues. They preached in the Jewish context. And the Jewish religious leaders were the ones who had means, motive, and opportunity to refute the position taken in these writings that Jesus in fact died on the cross for our sins, that he rose again. And we find no such writings coming out of that period. There is certainly Jewish opposition, but never is there any attempt to deal with these facts. We cannot rely upon some kind of alleged development to get rid conveniently of those things in the Gospels which disagree with the Quran 600 years later. That's not the way we do this sort of thing. My advice to all of you is not to read Raymond Brown. I mean, you can read him if you want to. It's a free country, but life is short. My advice to you, my advice to you is to read the New Testament itself. J.B. Phillips, who was one of the prime translators and paraphrasers of the New Testament, said when he did his translation, it was like wiring a house with the mains turned on. There is something about those materials that will impact you. They have what Phillips called the ring of truth about them. Yes, as to the Gospel of John, we should also point out that in terms of authorship, we don't have great difficulties with this. John had at least two students, Polycarp of Smyrna and Papias, both of them living into the beginning of the second century. And from them we know that the Gospel of John was written by John himself, and we have evidence that the writers of Matthew, Mark, and Luke were the traditional authors. That the author of Matthew was Matthew Levi, the tax collector. The author of Mark was John Mark, who was a companion to the Apostle Peter. And that Luke's gospel was written by the physician Paul, who accompanied St. Paul on his missionary journeys. So what we have here are materials that have to be faced as they stand. We can't successfully engage in a gerrymandering of this material to leave only certain things there which we feel comfortable with. And we must guard ourselves against falling into the trap of certain types of contemporary biblical scholarship which are subjective, as we've said, and not based upon a manuscript foundation that shows the variations that Mr. Ali has been talking about. So, my advice to you is read the stuff. Read the stuff. Don't take Mr. Ali's opinion. Don't take my opinion. See if it has the ring of truth when you read it. Thank you. I hate that thing.
Folks, in this last segment of our interchange before we take your questions, I want to clarify that our purpose here is not to win a debate or to score points, but to explore the issues. We want to understand. We want to get to know the truth about matters. Dr. Montgomery had said earlier on that all religions do not teach the same things, and we must find out which one does teach what is right. And in some way, I believe that God accepts people from all faiths, from all geographical regions because his mercy is wide and all-embracing. This is what we learn from the Quran. So I'm not here to criticize the faith of anyone. I'm not here to tell you your faith is wrong and you ought to be a Muslim. I'm just describing it the way I understand it. From my studies, this is what I see. As I've said before, Jesus either is a prophet of God, as Muslims believe him to be, or he is the God of the prophets. The belief that he is the God of the prophets depending on being able to prove that he resurrected from the dead. And so Christian apologists have to prove that he actually resurrected from the dead. To prove that, one has to prove that he was really dead and that he really did reappear after his known death. I think on both of these points, Dr. Montgomery it still remains to give us some of his presentation. And finally, I have shown actual examples of the evolution of the Gospels over time to show how the Gospels try to insist later on that Jesus really was dead and try to insist and multiply the appearances to really persuade us that Jesus really came back to life. Whether one might believe in that is really up to you, but I find it incredible. And this is what I've presented to you humbly. I hope nobody will take offense to that. I'm just as a student of Christianity. I have a BA degree with Laurentian University. I've studied under biblical scholars. And some of the things they have taught me, plus some of my own bias from the Muslim faith, all of this mixed together, my own interest, I presented to you what I could tonight. Finally, Dr. Montgomery raises a point about scholarship again, and I think he's right. It's not so much about which scholar said what, but examine things for yourselves. But notice that the scholars I've been referring to are contemporary scholars, like Raymond Brown just passed away a few years ago, and his book is still the recognized text in the field. Whereas Dr. Montgomery wants to rely on people like C.S. Lewis, Theodore Zahn, who he said wrote early this century, John A.T. Robinson, people who have died a long time ago, J.B. Phillips, and they were not here to recognize the current developments in scholarship. So when we're referring to scholars, one of the things I learned in logic is that we have to refer to contemporary scholarship unless there is a particular reason for referring to earlier scholarship. And here there's no particular reason except, as I see it, Dr. Montgomery wants to hold to an old school that has now been defunct. Now, Dr. Montgomery thinks that the development I spoke about in the Gospels are not really signs of development. Another Gospel may be giving more detail. But didn't he say that, in fact, F.F. Bruce is a good scholar? F.F. Bruce tells us that the theory that Matthew was written first and that Mark is an abbreviation of Matthew, that has been proven wrong. It is true that Matthew is a longer gospel by its inclusion of more material that is not found in Mark. But when we deal with something that is in Mark and we compare it into Matthew, we see that Matthew is the one that abbreviates the episode. We've seen that with Jairus' daughter. Mark has a twofold sequence. Jairus comes first, a servant comes later. Jairus comes and says, "My daughter is dying." The servant comes later to say the daughter is dead. In Matthew, that has been combined, compressed, so that the Jairus says, "My daughter is dead." So you can see that Matthew is shortening. Now, what about the dating of Acts of the Apostles? The New Jerome Biblical Commentary tells us that, in fact, it is a widely accepted convention that the dating of Acts is somewhere between AD 80 and 90. So that's a long time after Dr. Montgomery would want to place it. What about apostolic authorship of the Gospels? Is it true that the Gospels were written by disciples of Jesus? This has long been claimed, but modern scholarship has turned away from that. In particular, F.F. Bruce, looking at the way in which the narratives from Papias are worded and what we know about the Gospels and the composition today, he thinks that what Papias was talking about when he spoke about Matthew writing the Logia of the Lord is something that lay before the Q document, which eventually was incorporated into Matthew and Luke in their own ways with their own particular changes. So we cannot say that Matthew, the author of the fourth gospel, was the disciple of Jesus. So finally, I would like to remind Dr. Montgomery of what he himself wrote. He himself said that in his book, Where is History Going? On page 59, he said, "Next, let us look at the earliest of the four Gospels, Mark, which was written no later than AD 64 to 70. So I think my, even though I'm only a student and I'm still learning, the case I presented to you is strong. I have said that Jesus is either a prophet of God, as I would believe him to be, or he's the God of the prophets, as my Christian friends persuade me to believe. He is not the God of the prophets unless his resurrection from the dead can be proved. I think Dr. Montgomery has not proved it tonight, and in the light of my arguments, it's difficult to see how he would, and unless he does so, I would continue to believe that Jesus is the prophet of God. Thank you.
I was delighted when Mr. Ali cited me because I'm a contemporary scholar who is alive, and therefore I should be paid particular attention to, shouldn't I? My own opinion happens to be that Mark is the earliest of the Gospels. My point was that this is not something which is universally held, and it's impossible to arrive at an absolute judgment along that line. And if you cannot arrive at an absolute judgment, then you are not in a position to engage in the developmental activity that Mr. Ali is engaged in. That's my point. But let's, for the moment, shift away from the Gospel of John and go to what Mr. Ali and I happen to believe are earlier Gospels. What do you find? You find precisely the same divine picture of Jesus presented that you get in the Gospel of John. It is impossible to argue that Jesus is a Jewish boy scout helping little old ladies across the Sea of Galilee in the Synoptic Gospels and God Almighty suddenly in the Gospel of John. For example, in Mark, the earliest of the Gospels, if you will, Mark 1 begins, first verse, quoting Malachi in the Old Testament, Malachi 3:1. Malachi 3:1 says, I, Jehovah God, send my messenger to prepare the way before me. And the Gospel of Mark modifies that from the Old Testament to read, I send my messenger to prepare the way before thee, before the way of Jesus. Now, if an Orthodox Jew wrote that, the Orthodox Jew is identifying Jesus with the God of the Old Testament, and this stands as a beacon light at the very beginning of what Mr. Ali apparently thinks is the earliest gospel. Mark 2, Jesus forgives sin. He forgives sin. And the critics, the Sadducees and Pharisees say, who can forgive sin but God only? Does Jesus say, oops, oops, slip of the tongue, sorry? Not at all. He goes ahead and proves that he is able to forgive sin by healing the paralytic, because that's something they can see. They can't see the invisible fact of the forgiveness of sin, but they can see the healing of the paralytic. This is a clear indication in Mark 2 that Jesus is agreeing with those who see that he is taking on divine functions. Mark 14. Jesus is crucified on the charge of blasphemy after he says, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with all the heavenly host. And that Son of Man line comes from Daniel and Ezekiel. It is the divine messianic prophet who is coming. It is God coming at the end of time to clean up history. And the high priest recognizes this and says, what need do we have for further witnesses? Not a bad idea since they were all perjured anyway. He says he is guilty of blasphemy. That's Mark. If you go to Matthew, you have passages in Matthew 1, Jesus, you will call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Directly contradicting, for example, the Quranic view that we don't need a savior from our sins. Matthew 20, Jesus says, I come to give my life a ransom for many, the substitutionary atonement. Matthew 28, after Jesus' resurrection, he says, all power is given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore, baptizing in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. One of the foundations of Trinitarian doctrine. Now, all of this stuff about Jesus is written by the same people. Isn't it strange that we can somehow ignore this kind of material and end up with a Jesus who remarkably fits a picture in the Quran 600 years later? And notice, even if the New Testament were unreliable, it would in no sense establish the Quranic view. If Mr. Ali were correct, the New Testament would be so fraught with problems, you couldn't even derive from it a view of Jesus that would fit the Quran. It's essential to take the New Testament material seriously, all of it. Now, Mr. Ali says, I haven't demonstrated the resurrection. Really? First of all, the documents that present the resurrection are primary source, reliable documents. The witnesses in those documents are reliable people who had no reason to engage in deception or error, nor were they drunk and disorderly. These were people whose testimony you could rely on. These people tell us that they themselves saw Jesus crucified, dead, buried, and resurrected. Now, I don't know what more really we could ask for. Historians can only go with the best material available to them. And the best material here, the only material, is the material that later on the church collected in the New Testament. And we have independent evidence of the reliability of that material. My feeling is, in an area like this, that we've each got to do some careful work ourselves. We've got to look at the material in the New Testament. We also should look at the Quran. We should have contact with these religious materials. And then we should ask ourselves first, how reliable are they, and how can we test their claims? In the case of the Quran, we have only Muhammad's own claim that this is a revelation. In the case of the New Testament, we have the Old Testament prophecies pointing to Jesus. A mathematician has calculated that 25 of those prophecies, even if you take only a 25% chance of their success, if combined and we see their fulfillment, specific prophecies like a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, he'll be sold for 30 pieces of silver. If you take 25 of those at only 25% likelihood for each one, you get a probability of 1 in 1,000 trillion against this coming about by chance. We have those prophecies backing up the life of Christ, and then we have the miraculous resurrection attesting what he said about himself. And he said that he was God Almighty come to earth. One of his disciples said, "Show us the Father." And Jesus said, "Have I been so long with you, Philip, and you have not known me? He who has seen me has seen the Father." I think that we ought to face that sort of thing and not wander about in the realms of some vague contemporary biblical scholarship. I think what we should do is to go to the sources and then try to face the implications of this for our lives personally. Thank you. Try to run over here first.
As many Jewish and Muslim scholars of the New Testament would agree 100% with your attestation that the primary documents are absolutely essential and they must be studied in the original languages, which you have done. In that context, I would draw to your attention the authority of the texts that you claim to have absolute authority. In particular, certain famous examples, namely the Gospel of John, in which the claim is made that Jesus was crucified after the Passover, whereas the Synoptic Gospels very clearly state it to be before the Passover. Unless Jesus was crucified twice, there is no way of harmonizing this. Likewise, you claim that the text supports the idea of Jesus' divinity, whereas study of the original language text, as you rightly assert, show very clearly that, for example, claims such as Jesus' preparation as a body in the wider New Testament in Hebrews 10:5 is refuted by reference in the original Greek in Hebrews 10:5 by reference to the original Psalm 40, where that word is found to be false and found to be a copying error. Under those circumstances, how, with these clear contradictions in the original language texts that have been proven and that have not been refuted at any time in history by evangelical or other Christian scholars, how can you still purport to claim that the New Testament remains a document that we can rely upon?
Yes, I'm not clear as to what you're saying about Hebrews 10. The fact of the matter is that the New Testament writers, in quoting the Old Testament, generally quoted from Greek translations of the Old Testament, because they themselves were writing in Greek. So they generally used the Septuagint, which had been translated between 300 and 100 BC, but there are other Greek versions that were available to them. So I don't know of anyone who has argued that Paul or whoever wrote Hebrews made some sort of ghastly mistake in his use of the Old Testament. If you think so, then I think the burden probably rests on you to show this. And as far as the date of the Passover and so on, the synoptics and John have been easily reconciled on this, and there are any number of sources to which you can go to see this. Harmonies of the Gospel assist with this, but the commentators that handle that kind of thing across the centuries. And listen, if, let's say, it were the case that the New Testament materials had some problems like that in them, let's just say for the sake of argument that were the case, that would hardly mean that the major events set forth by eyewitnesses and close associates of eyewitnesses never occurred. I mean, occasionally in court, we get a witness who makes a mistake, but that doesn't mean he never saw the traffic accident at all.
Yes, another question. Yes, the lady over there.
My question is for Mr. Ali. I want to ask you, if an event happened, perhaps there have been many people that witnessed this event somehow. Do you agree that if these people were called to be witnesses in a court of law, that under examination and cross-examination, that none of them is going to tell the same account, strictly speaking? Do you agree?
What you should be aware of in the light of my presentation is that, and not only do the Gospels have varying details, which we should accept if that were all there were to it, but the variations are such that when we line them up in the sequence in which they were written, we see a clear development of ideas. And we are sure that if, for example, Luke knew about Lazarus being raised from the dead, that Luke would have mentioned this. Because Luke tells us about Lazarus being in heaven and the rich man asking him to drop down some water. And the conclusion is that if the dead were to come back to life then and tell people about that, nobody would believe him either if they didn't already believe in Moses and the prophets. I know you have your hand up, but bear with me. So the point is that...
No, I'm not talking about biblical sense. I'm just talking about everyday...
Of course, I'm answering your question based on the context of our discussion tonight. So allow me to finish, and then I'll come back to you any clarification that you have, if you don't mind. So the point is that if Luke knew that Lazarus had been raised from the dead in the dramatic fashion in which death is recounted in John's Gospel, Luke would have certainly recounted that. But Luke talks a lot about Lazarus and his sisters, Mary and Martha, and Jesus' association with them, being at the house and all of that. But Luke does not spill a word about Jesus having raised Lazarus from the dead in this dramatic fashion. It seems clear that what we have is a development in the ideas among the Gospels, so that there is a simple resurrection from the dead
in Mark's Gospel, a more complex one in Luke, where the widow of son's named sons is already in the coffin on the way to the grave, and then a more dramatic one where Lazarus was already in the tomb stinking for 4 days, already bandaged and everything, and then he comes out in that dramatic fashion as well. So if that dramatic raising of the dead of Lazarus were known, it would have been in all of the Gospels, especially in the Gospel of Luke, who makes mention of Lazarus. He knew Lazarus and the family, but not this detail about the resurrection from the dead. So, yes, to answer your question, there will be details that are differing from one witness to another. But if we see this sign of development, we should conclude that some of the witnesses here are not really telling it like it is.
The reason I asked that question is...
I'm afraid I'm going to stop you because I must give everybody a chance to ask their questions.
All right.
You had an answer whether it satisfies you or not.
Okay.
My question is to Shabir Ali. You started your address with discussing perhaps if Jesus had died but not been resurrected, then at that stage he'd have failed and to some extent would have been guilty, and that he managed to reverse that. Now, taking that as a proposition, you suggested a centurion might have wanted to save him, having been converted to Christianity at that stage. If it's right that in Jesus dying, his belief also would have died, why would he want to save someone who has misled him? That's something I'd ask you to help me with, but with that also, in terms of your treatment of the New Testament documents, I wonder whether you've considered the work by Simon Greenleaf, who's an American expert on evidence, who looked at the four New Testament documents to see if they were written, firstly by people who claimed to write them, but also looked at them as documents compared with each other, to see whether they were reliable documents, and found that, in fact, evidentially, they're more reliable than the evidence that sent many people to their death in the electric chair in the course of law. And perhaps you can address those 2 points for me.
Yes, very quickly, yes, I'm familiar with the work of Simon Greenleaf. I read his article, which is compiled by Professor Montgomery in his book, The Law Above the Law. And I found that Simon Greenleaf is not only a dated scholar, he was writing more than 100 years ago, but he started out with the presuppositions that the Christian basic claims are true. And if you start out with that presupposition, then everything is easy to prove. If you start out by assuming what you're setting out to prove, then your proof becomes very easy, but also of very little worth to students like myself. As for the contradiction which you noticed in my presentation, I agree with you, there is that contradiction there, but that contradiction I did not invent. In fact, that contradiction is inherent in the gospel materials themselves and in the apologetic works. You are right. There will be so many people who would have believed in Jesus despite his death. His death on the cross does not prove that he is wrong. It proves that the people who crucified him are wrong. But the way the gospels are written in the light of Paul's claims is to prove that Jesus was the Davidic Messiah. And if he were the Davidic Messiah, he had to sit on the throne of David and rule. He couldn't be out hanging on a cross. So if the Gospels are correct on this point, then nobody should believe in Jesus. The Christian apologists have taken up that side of it, and they have claimed, see, that's why the disciples did not believe. And moreover, the fact that they believed later is a definite proof that they were convinced that Jesus rose from the dead. Because had they not received this conviction, they could never have believed in Jesus in the light of his death. So that contradiction is there in the Gospels. It is true that even if I, as a Muslim, were to find out that Jesus actually died on the cross, I would then go back to the Quran and reinterpret it in the light of that conviction that Jesus died on the cross. But I would see no reason to disbelieve in this great man. He performed many miraculous deeds. His teachings are wonderful. And we should believe in him even if he died. But the Gospels are so written that the Gospels have him as the Davidic Messiah who could not be defeated by his enemies, and apparently he was. The only way to turn around that is to prove that he was resurrected from the dead, and this is what the Christian apologists like Josh McDowell and Norman Geisler and others try to prove. But as I've shown tonight, the proof is weak.
Thank you. Now, can I ask for, I'm trying to balance this so that we have questions to each of the two speakers fairly equally. Is there a question for Professor Montgomery? Yes, gentlemen there.
Forgive me, I'm no scholar and
not
well read. It's very important to know who the writer is, to know where they're coming from, as you mentioned, Dr. Montgomery. But can we conclude without any doubt whatsoever that the writers of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are who you claim that they were, without any shadow of a doubt, is there something that proves that these people who you mentioned were the writers of those said documents?
Where empirically...
Sorry, one other point. Sorry. It seems remarkable to me that you make the point that God, our Creator, would leave us with contradictions in his book as a means of guidance to us, that he would leave us with contradictions.
All right, the last point first. I don't happen to believe that God would do this. I said only that even if Mr. Ali were correct, that there were some, or not Mr. Ali, the gentleman who raised the point over here, were correct, that there were some minor factual difficulties in the book of Hebrews, that would hardly displace the argument for the deity of Christ, or for his death on the cross, or for the resurrection. You see, I agree with you that a genuine revelation from God is going to be a revelation which is entirely reliable. Okay, on the first point that you raise, no historical or empirical fact can be proven 100%. This is because new evidence can always arise. One could, in theory, be mistaken, etc. All empirical or factual knowledge is established on the basis of probability rather than absolute certainty, as in the case of formal mathematics, formal logic, or pure mathematics. So I cannot say to you that there is no conceivable possibility that the four Gospels were written by people other than those I have mentioned. But the very best historical evidence supports the authorship as I've indicated. And one of the illustrations of this is the material from Papias and Polycarp. Classical historians, if they had that kind of external corroboration of authorship for other works of the classical world, it would be ecstatic. I mean, they would sell their grandmothers to get that kind of extrinsic backup for the claims of other writers of the classical world. And this is why, for example, Sir Frederick Kenyon, who was principal librarian of the British Museum and the greatest authority on New Testament textual criticism of the last generation, said that the New Testament documents are the best attested documents of the classical world. Nothing approaches them as to their value historically. Yes, he used the word authenticity in relation to this.
No. Some of the question for Mr. Ali.
I wonder if you could help me with this, Mr. Ali, because I'm not entirely sure I understand you. My understanding of your position is this, that you assert that the Gospels, as we have them, are, in a way, propaganda to the extent that they are trying to prove something the authors do not really believe, in that they are trying to assert that Jesus died, did not die, and they are effectively asserting something that they do not believe in, thereby, namely the divinity of Christ. And if that's right, if you're really asserting that, I tell you what my problem is. It seems to me that speaking as a tired old hack that's got 20 or 30 years of power, it seems to me that you're asserting that they lie. But people lie, in my experience, in order to get themselves out of trouble. These authors, on your case, lied in order to get themselves into trouble and persecuted by the whole Roman world. Now, perhaps you'd just like to comment on that, because you see, I think that's incredible.
Okay. I stand so that I can see the gentleman. Morris, so you can see me as well. No, I have not asserted that the writers of the Gospels or the preachers of Christianity were lying at any point. What I do believe, as many biblical scholars would hold, is that stories circulated about Jesus circulated orally for the first 30 years, according to F.F. Bruce, and eventually they'll be put into the Gospels, one after another. But the oral circulation continues, so even though one Gospel is written, stories are still being circulated orally. And if people are prone to a particular belief, the oral circulation tends to confirm to that belief over time. And so we can see that the stories develop, and more stories are put into circulation. It is known that Jesus raised somebody from the dead, and now suddenly there is some other person who was also raised from the dead. Somebody heard about that person, and somebody heard about Lazarus. And eventually, these stories are available at the time when the documents are compiled. The compiler has to look at all of the available stories and see what really makes sense, what gels with what we believe, what we know to be true, and then they collect from that vast spectrum. So they collect the later developed stories, and we can now compare them side by side. Now, why would they collect stories that would get them into trouble? In fact, your question seems to indicate that the original disciples of Jesus actually wrote these documents and said these things, and then they got into trouble because of these documents. Quite the contrary. As Michael Grant writes in his book, A Historian's Review of the Gospels, he says that the Gospels were written after the Jewish revolt in the year 66 to 70. And by that time, Christianity had become Gentile, away from its original Jewish roots. And so with a new context in mind, people saw things differently. The writers were all divorced from the original core mother church, and so their memories of what had happened had to rely on second-hand memories. And so what they wrote down, in all honesty, leaves before us today the opportunity to study those Gospels, and with our eyes open we see that even though we do not need to accuse anyone of lying, we can see a development in the story. Now when I say that Jesus did not definitely die, as far as we can tell from the evidence, I'm not saying that anyone claimed that he was dead and deliberately falsified a report. I'm saying that Jesus must have appeared dead to them, as one would appear dead to a person in ancient times, but such a person to us wouldn't be factually dead until we verify that he's actually brain dead, because we can resuscitate such an individual. And if such a resuscitation of Jesus was accomplished, then that is the work of God in whom we do believe, and we believe that he could have resuscitated Jesus and raised him into heaven. That is the Muslim belief.
I'm afraid we're going to get to the end here. I'm going to have one last question for Professor Montgomery in public. Those of you who wish to ask further questions can do so upstairs over sandwiches and drink and so on. So who's got a question for Professor Montgomery? I'll take the gentleman right at the back.
Thank you very much. Basically, it's a question to both of you. It looks like, after hearing both of the debate, what it looks like is believe in law. That we've got to let some of the scholars to decide who to believe and who not to. And the people who are farmers, they need to follow the scholars, and they don't have their own opinion about it. Now that is actually, I think that is flawed, because you don't need to go to the scholars to say who God is or whether there is a God. Now, what do we base on? We base on the documents, right? For Islam, there is Quran. For Christianity, there is Bible. Now, obviously, we need to go to the sources, and there is no doubt about it. Prove that the books itself, themselves, yes. I agree with that. But what I don't understand is history, as we know it, is not the basis of truth. And witnesses can lie, as we know it in law. Witnesses can lie for innocent reasons, or they can mistake for different reasons. Now my question is to both of you, is for the existence of God, what is the entrance? I mean, there must be a proof, rational proof. We are rational human beings, there is no doubt. What is the rational proof given in Christianity and given in Islam that there is God? That is my question.
That's a big question. I'm going to give him about a minute each. Perhaps you could just give us a thought each on that. It's a very, very big topic that plainly can't be dealt with in answer to a quick question. But perhaps I could just have a thought from each of you gentlemen on that.
Yes, very quickly, I do not believe the rational proof for the existence of God from within Islam is different than it is from within Christianity. In fact, in the Middle Ages, Muslim and Christian philosophers borrowed from each other, and in particular what is called the Kalam cosmological argument developed by Muslim scholars had been used later on by Christian scholars as well, like Thomas Aquinas, and recently our very own Dr. William Lean Craig, with whom I had some dialogues. So the arguments are quite similar. However, I should add that once we examine those arguments, we see the proof of the existence of a God who is not part of the universe, the God that is not made up of the atoms that form this universe. And it would seem that that very proof counts to a certain degree against the Christian conception of the incarnation of God. For to be incarnate, God would then become part of the universe. He would be made up of the atoms of the universe and somehow change from one mode to another. But this is something Dr. Montgomery may clarify for us.
The evidence for God's existence can be found everywhere. The Book of Psalms says that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The source of the universe requires the belief in a God. But the real issue, it seems to me, is not so much that. The real issue is, what is that God like? You can go to philosophical arguments such as those of William Lane Craig or Muslim theologians in order to get to the existence of some kind of first cause, some cosmological principle on the basis of which we explain the universe as we have it. But, quite frankly, that kind of a God has never saved anybody. Our problem is that we are radically self-centered. And we need to be changed. We need to become people who consider the interests of others more important than ourselves. And that requires a radical change in the human heart. And therefore, I think if I can modify your question a little bit, it might be, how can we find a God who loves us and who can restore us to be the kind of people we ought to be? And there, you're going to have to go into history and see if such a God has ever revealed himself here in this world, because that's where we live, that's where we operate. A God in the cosmos is not going to help us here. We've got to find a solution, if there is any such solution, right here in human history. And that's why it really is critical to check out revelation claims. Did God in fact reveal himself or not? That's why this debate is so important, why the subject was so well chosen.